Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, disappearing daguerreotypes. An unlikely team of conservators and physicists tries to save some of the first photographs ever made. We'll also hear about Canada's rebranding campaign. Bucking its reputation for humility and good manners, Canada's government is spending millions to position itself as a superpower. And robot love. Stories of unexpected emotional attachments people form with machines designed for healthcare and house cleaning. But first, making sense of Syria. A year ago this week, the UN declared Syria to be in a state of civil war. Government restrictions on media have limited coverage of the conflict that has killed an estimated 30,000 people so far. Last week, the British government officially recognized an opposition coalition as the Syrian people's sole legitimate representative. There's speculation on whether the U.S. will follow suit or if the Obama administration will otherwise support a rebellion that few Americans understand. Vice, a monthly magazine popular with the under-30 crowd for its provocative imagery and gritty topics, devoted its November issue to photographs and articles about the resistance, the government supporters, political history, literature, and fallout of the Syrian conflict. Vice's senior editor Aaron Lake Smith is on the line to tell us more about the issue, which is free, by the way. Aaron, great to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me back on, Virginia.
Vice is known for pushing boundaries, certainly, but the singular focus of this Syria issue is a departure. So what was behind that decision?
Well, Vice, we ran a Iraq issue back in 2007. And we were obviously watching the presidential elections and thinking about kind of how to theme our November issue. And it just seemed like Syria was kind of the obvious choice as far as of all the Arab Spring revolts. This is kind of the major one to look at because Syria is the linchpin of the Middle East. I mean, what happens in Syria now is going to determine the fate of all the adjacent countries of Israel, of Lebanon, Iraq, Kurdistan. And so we were watching the revolt. We were watching kind of it stagnate and in turn into a civil war and become extremely violent and prolonged. And we were interested in the issues at play. Obviously, we wanted to get some reporters in there, have them do some on-the-ground work and report back to us what is actually happening. People, you know, there's a couple of magazines that have been able to get reporters in, but for a while there, coverage is pretty sparse.
Well, it is a pretty bold move. Now, this is Vice is available for free at American Apparel shops and other, let's face it, we'll call them hipster hangouts. I just read that the average age of Vice media employee is 26 years old. Are you aiming to make Syria interesting to 20-somethings here? Is that what's behind this?
Well, I think of all, you know, of course, the Arab Spring is of interest to young people because it's being led by young people in those countries. And, you know, of all the revolts, this one in Syria, I mean, it was sparked by teenagers who, you know, last year they were in Daraa and they ended up spray painting Down with Assad on their school, ended up getting their fingernails pulled out and tortured. And that was kind of the first indignity that led to this prolonged revolt. A lot of the fighters, you know, both on the army side and the FSA side are young men and women. People are suffering, are the young. So we think that, you know, this being a revolution led by the young, that young people over the world who are reading our magazine would be interested in what happens to them and kind of what they're doing in their countries and how they're kind of expressing themselves politically.
I read throughout these articles, too, that oftentimes reporters, at least one photographer, are frustrated that news about Syria isn't getting out. Certainly many, many of the Syrians interviewed to say people just don't care. You know, why don't you care? We're suffering here. So how were you trying to tell this story differently from other news reports?
Well, we wanted to get reporters in there on the ground and experience, try to get us some scenes, try to show us what's actually happening. I mean, you have lots of magazines out there that are telling us the kind of mechanics, the complicated mechanics at play within the Syrian opposition and with the government and with the Kurdish state. You know, we wanted to actually see through the reporter's eyes what's happening, see through the photojournalist's eyes. And, you know, that's kind of what we do is experiential journalism. We have people actually go in, embed among the rebels or hang out, go to a protest among Assad supporters in France and in Paris. We felt like that would best show what's actually going on rather than kind of sitting here in the U.S. and talking, you know, talking without actually being there firsthand.
Well, we have one of those intrepid reporters, I must say, on the line with us, Anna Therese Day. She's an independent producer and reporter for Vice magazine. She was quite literally smuggled into the country to embed herself with the FSA. That's the lead opposition group. Now, she's on the line with us from Ramallah in the Palestinian-controlled West Bank. So we have a spotty line, but I really want to thank you, Anna, for being with us.
Thank you for having me today.
So you wrote about gun running with the Free Syrian Army. I mean, how did you gain access, first of all?
Well, generally I report on civil society stories. And actually, the fact that I was able to gain access to the gun runners really speaks to the desperation of the situation in Syria. The folks that I met first were low-level arms traffickers who were normal citizens before the revolution. And they were people who were car salesmen. I met a teacher, a government engineer, and all have been forced into these marginal and dangerous industries as a result of necessity from the very, very violent crackdown that is now consuming Syria.
You met them mostly in Kilis, is that how I pronounce it, in Turkey?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us about crossing the border from Kilis, and with whom and where you landed.
Yes. Well, I spent about a month and a half with many of these contacts, and whenever you're inside Syria, there is no safe place currently. In the, quote, liberated areas of northern Syria, the areas that don't have government presence still have barrel bombs, which are industrial barrels of TNT and shrapnel that are dropped from government airplanes. In the city of Aleppo, that still has some government presence, there are snipers everywhere. So there is no safe place, so you end up becoming much closer with your contacts than you would in any normal scenario. So I went in with two colonels in the FSA and a gunrunner who I'd been working with for about a month and a half, and blindfolded, put in a car in Kilis, Turkey, and we entered illegally into Syria. This isn't as uncommon as one would think. Actually, all of the defected generals in the Syrian government have to enter and exit Turkey illegally because they were never granted passports under the Assad regime. So when we entered Syria, we ended up near the Azov border, which is the normal border crossing, but had entered illegally.
That's Anna Therese Day. She's a journalist who wrote about gun running with the Free Syrian Army for Vice's Syria issue. Aaron Lake Smith, senior editor at Vice, is also with us. But I'd love to continue with you, Anna, while we have you on the line. You know, you met several different people, as you mentioned, a colonel in the FSA, but many of them had very similar stories about how they came to fight. Maybe you can give us a typical story about the FSA members, founded less than a year ago. Where are they getting arms and where are they getting the people?
What I found most interesting is that many of these people that I met were not anti-government originally, even about maybe 2 years ago they weren't, before the uprising. It wasn't until they were, of course, critical when the government started cracking down on Syrians in the south. But most of them wanted to mind their own business, quite frankly. When the government moved in on Aleppo and the northern towns, people remained loyal to the government in many scenarios, and it wasn't until there was just mass violence against civilians who were even trying to stay out of it that people felt their only option was armed resistance. They see it as self-defense. When I was there was a limbo period. Everyone was waiting for the American election because there's a perception that the American government is the only Western ally with their foot on the brakes in arming the FSA. Since the election, the United States hasn't moved on that yet. So right now, there hasn't been movement on that yet, other than small arms shipments from the Gulf. But the majority of weapons and money is coming from private donors in the Gulf, and that is what has emboldened some of the more radical elements of the FSA and foreign fighters, as opposed to the majority, which are pluralist fighters.
Aaron, I would love to get your perspective on this. Reading through the many articles, one on regime supporters, many of whom say this is not a civil war, it's being funded by outside agitators. How legitimate do you think that claim is after all of the work that you did on Syria?
Yeah, I don't, you know, that's complicated, obviously, because I feel like it was actually started by the Assad regime, and then this kind of Sunni support from the Gulf states started coming in. So, I mean, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy if you look at it, where Assad is saying, oh, we have these terrorists, we have money coming in from the Gulf, we have America or other states are coming in and kind of interfering and arming the rebels or helping them out with whatever kind of support they're offering, that, you know, it isn't weapons support exactly yet. And so everything Assad has been saying about, you know, this group is kind of, it's coming true and kind of legitimizing his kind of side. You know, it's become a very polarized situation. And, you know, I think what started out as mostly a civil society movement of a Syrian patriotic movement against indignity, it kind of devolved into full-blown civil war. And I think that both sides have legitimate claims, but ultimately, you know, in doing the issue, we sided with the rebels. We sided with the people who don't want to be governed by this man who didn't even want to be president, and his father, who was president before him, who did the same thing. Who, whenever a group would kind of come forward, he would just crush them. I mean, just this kind of response to uprisings, this brutal response that breeds hatred and resentment among the Syrian people, and they're not going to let it go.
Aaron Lake Smith is senior editor at Vice Magazine. And Aaron, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Anna, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna Therese Day is an independent producer and journalist whose work has been featured in Vice Magazine, on CNN International, the BBC, and Al Jazeera English. Her article, Gun Running with the Free Syrian Army, is in the recent issue of Vice, which is devoted to Syria. We have a link to it online at wordofmouthradio.org. And now to some dangers much closer to home. This week, a report released by Duke University found that 85% of couches sold in the U.S. contained at least one part of a chemical compound that is suspected of causing cancer. The compound, known as TDCCP, is a flame retardant and was banned from the use of manufacture of children's pajamas back in 1977. The report called to mind a conversation we had about the tens of thousands of chemicals the average person ingests each day, from our morning cup of coffee to brushing our teeth before bed. The FDA requires pharmaceuticals to be tested, but most of the chemicals found in many household products are never tested at all. We spoke to Ariane Cohen. She's a journalist who describes herself as a paranoid and curious person. Ariane decided to have every man-made substance in her body tested through biomonitoring technology. It's a process she wrote about for Popular Science. We spoke to her when the article was published in 2009 and asked her to tell us about common chemicals that we're exposed to every day.
Sure, we are absolutely surrounded by them. The clothing that you're wearing right now, it was sprayed with flame retardants and antibacterials and anti-mold formulations so that it could survive its shipment from wherever it was made. Ditto with the furniture that you're sitting on and touching right now. All of the cosmetics and toiletries that you use, shampoos, shaving creams, lotions, the vast majority of them are filled with man-made chemicals, and you can see that on the labels.
Are any of these chemicals linked to diseases or to the significant increase in cancer rates in the U.S. over the past 70 years?
It's extremely hard to prove causation when you're looking at chemicals and cancer. There's only approximately 20 chemicals that are considered absolute definite carcinogens, and it's just because the body is so complicated. And to give you an idea, there's 85,000 man-made chemicals currently in use in industrial manufacturing in the U.S., which means that it's incredibly hard to narrow it down. This said, we've seen extremely rapid increases in common cancers in the last 3 decades or so. Just to give you an idea, leukemia and brain cancers in children are up by a third just since 1975.
Wow.
So there's a huge rise there, and logic would tell you that there's some sort of connection, but it's very difficult to pinpoint what that connection is.
So 85,000 chemicals, but you went through biomonitoring, a technology that addresses the presence of and toxicity of man-made chemicals in the body. Give us a quick primer in biomonitoring.
Sure. Biomonitoring, it's the study of chemical loads in the body. because what's been happening is for the last 30 years, we've been using, you know, tens of thousands of new chemicals, and yet no one was quite sure what effect they have on the body or whether they're even in the body. And so biomonitoring is really the very first step of determining that causation we were just talking about. So biomonitoring is very simply testing people to figure out what's in their bodies, whether these chemicals are actually hanging around for a long time, or if, you know, they're just sort of there for a moment and then disappear.
Well, so you put yourself there on the table. You were tested at a lab at Rutgers University using the same methods used on citizens by the CDC. What did your tests reveal?
Yeah, the CDC does something really interesting. They do something called NHANES every year, which is like a census of human bodies, and they round up a few thousand very lucky people and show up at their doorstep, and quite literally they show up at their doorstep, and do an intense amount of testing. And just in the last 10 years, they've started testing for chemicals, and right now they test for about 250 chemicals. And I basically did very similar testing, and I was filled with chemicals like most Americans are. My test results were very normal as compared to other people, but very abnormal as compared to previous generations. I mean, our grandparents just did not have these chemicals. I mean, I was just filled with plastics and plasticizers, dioxins and furans, which are older chlorinated chemicals that, mm-hmm. that usually come from garbage incineration, and they've decreased since the 1980s, but they're the gift that keeps on giving. They're stored in your fat cells in the body, and they just keep reappearing, which is really scary.
We should point out that this test doesn't tell you if you're going to get cancer, for example, or which chemicals are most toxic, just the types of chemicals that are present in your body. So you named some of the things that were found in your body, but is that information useful?
It's useful to scientists on a large scale. If you're looking at the American population and saying, hey, a really significant number of people have, say, PFOA, it's a chemical that's in Teflon used in cooking pans.
Mm-hmm.
And,
Nonstick pans.
That chemical is associated with cancer. That's very useful information. On an individual level, it's not so useful.
There's also bisphenol A or BPA and a lot of estrogen. Some estimates say that 6 pounds per American per year of estrogen chemicals. You cite a truly frightening statistic earlier that out of the 85,000 chemicals registered with the federal government, the majority have never been studied. Let's go back to that. Why not?
So our government likes to use a sort of innocent until proven guilty system for pretty much everything, including chemicals. So the Food and Drug Administration, they very stringently test pharmaceuticals, and the Environmental Protection Agency tests the environment, but there's no real oversight body that forces testing of cosmetics and toiletries and over-the-counter products. Just all the stuff that's in your house, essentially, has never been tested. The only thing that they do test for is to make sure that it won't make you immediately sick.
Well, so if they're hesitant to pull any chemicals off the market, what can people do if they want to reduce the number of chemicals they ingest on a daily basis?
The most important thing you can do is read your labels. I have really changed my habits since I did this article. I used to sort of bathe myself in lotion and shampoo and all sorts of kind of female toiletry products every single day, and I've really just stopped. Because you don't need them, and you look at what's in the label, and you're literally just slathering this stuff on your skin, and you have no idea what the long-term effects of it are. You can also cut down on carpets and draperies, which are both heavily sprayed before they get to you, and also they house chemicals. You know, if you're spraying stuff in your house, it'll kind of stay in your carpet forever.
How about things like air filters? You know, are those useful?
They are to a point, but it's much more strategic to just not use products that are potentially dangerous.
Ariane Cohen is a freelance journalist and human guinea pig of sorts. After we spoke with her, a Senate committee voted to pass a Safe Chemicals Act, which advocates say is necessary to overhaul the Toxic Substance Controls Act made way back in 1976. That bill has not been discussed on the Senate floor as yet. A link to Ariane's Popular Science article about testing her own body for chemicals is on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. Coming up, the Live Free or Die Nation. That's what a group of New Hampshire secessionists are hoping for anyway.
And I don't think at all it's a traitorous idea. I think it's an inherently American idea. I mean, to deny that New Hampshire has the right to secede is to say that the original 13 colonies didn't have a right to secede. There were many states that signed on to the Union explicitly with the clause that and with the understanding that they could leave at any time.
We'll learn more about their cause when Word of Mouth continues. New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the aftermath of the election, talk of secession is stirring in every state in the Union. The first petition came out of Louisiana the day after the election. By then, secessionist sentiments of the Old South had already been stirring right here in the Great North. Word of Mouth correspondent Sean Hurley recently met up with members of the Foundation for New Hampshire Independence to find out more.
Like everything else these days, petitioning for secession is just a few clicks away. Simply visit the White House's We the People webpage, jot down your thoughts, and hit submit. If your petition reaches the critical threshold of 25,000 signatures, it gets passed along to a White House representative for further review and a formal response. Aside from the more serious applications, there are petitions that thoroughly lack the light of day. For example, there is a petition that President Obama do the hokey pokey. There's a petition, possibly submitted by Cormac McCarthy, to abolish the current legal system and replace it with an apocalyptic gang of motorcycle-riding judges.
I would recommend Harley Davidson.
And alongside the 70 or so secession petitions, there's also a petition to deport all the people who signed them. Neil Connor, a founding member of the secessionist group the Foundation for New Hampshire Independence, finds this latter petition peculiar. Why, he wonders, does talk of secession strike a chord of treason?
And I don't think at all it's a traitorous idea. I think it's an inherently American idea. I mean, to deny that New Hampshire has the right to secede is to say that the original 13 colonies didn't have a right to secede. There were many states that signed on to the Union explicitly with the clause that, and with the understanding that they could leave at any time. And I think that when, just as embodied in the Declaration of Independence and as embodied in the New Hampshire Constitution, when the government steps beyond its prescribed bounds, the citizens have a right to formulate a new government.
The Foundation's chief grievance relates to this sense of overreach, that a faraway group of long-armed officials has increasingly too much say and too mighty a grip on our local and personal experience.
For me, it's the TSA. I travel, I fly by plane, and I get groped almost every time I go through the TSA because I don't want to go through the body scanners. I think that's an invasion of privacy. I think that's a very overt one, but our privacy has been eroded year after year, especially since the introduction of the Patriot Act, which really woke me up. Right now, the NSA is building a humongous facility out in Utah to monitor all of our electronic communications. There really is no privacy and no Fourth Amendment.
Vince Perfetto, president of the Foundation, is equally troubled by our financial arrangement with the federal government.
For about the past 25 to 30 years, New Hampshire has been one of the top five donor states in America. So consistently, every single year, New Hampshire citizens are giving more to the federal government than they're getting back. For every dollar that we give them, then we, you know, beg for our own money back, and they give us 74 cents back with strings attached.
Both Vince and Neil are quick to point out that as a nonprofit, their foundation is strictly educational. They aren't here to start a fire, just a dialogue. The foundation won't be crafting legislation or endorsing candidates. They didn't even submit the original petition that New Hampshire secede. And despite the timing, their effort is not a referendum on President Obama's reelection.
We've been working since about March. We incorporated in September. So this is 100% not result of the federal elections that happened a week ago.
Instead, both Vince Perfetto and Neil Connor believe they're following a historical imperative.
Actually, about 100 years ago, there were about 64 countries in the world. Today, there are officially about 194. So the entire world is going towards smaller nations. Bigger nations are on their way out. Smaller nations are on their way in. This has been a trend throughout the entire world for the past 100 years.
In fact, Vince suggests a domino effect would result nationally if New Hampshire were to secede.
You know, when New Hampshire becomes an independent nation, I think that the other states will respond by saying, you know, oh, you can do that? Look at how prosperous they are. I think we should do the same thing. So that's what we expect to happen.
So would our independent nation still be called New Hampshire? Or how about Concordia? Would we have our own military? Old man on the mountain money. Neil Connor isn't thinking that far ahead.
So as to what New Hampshire would look like as an independent country, you mentioned, will we have a president? Well, the governor used to be called the president in New Hampshire. You know, I don't have a flag. I don't have a, you know, favorite anthem for New Hampshire. But it's a touchy subject. And there will be a lot of knee-jerk reactions. But the best thing we can do is start the dialogue.
While the current evidence suggests that we won't soon have a President Hassan or be changing our national anthem to Super Secret Project's Granite State of Mind, we do live in the Live Free or Die state. And if we want to keep that motto on our license plate, we should welcome any discussion about the true meaning of democracy. Then again, there's always that petition about the motorcycle riding judges. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
Yeah, I'm up at Conway. Now I'm down in Manchester next to Adam Sandler, but I'll be Woods forever. I'm the new Salinger, cause I could live anywhere, but I choose to live here, the middle of nowhere. I used to
shop in for more on the Foundation for New Hampshire Independence and the secessionist movement, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
The saloon at State Street. Catch me up at Gilly's after hours for some late eat. It's not the Kangamangus, it's the Kankamagus. It's a scenic byway that I like to drive in August. Made it shaped like a key, also where I like to ski. Tell by my belt buckle that I'm most definitely
New
from
Hampshire. Hey.
Canada, as the old Robin Williams joke goes, is like a really huge loft apartment above a really great party. Americans tend to think of Canada as a punchline or the mystical country where healthcare is free and Justin Bieber came from. Our colleagues over at Studio 360 have launched a slogan contest for Canada, but first they set out to find out what Americans know about the country to the north.
Do you know the capital of Canada?
No.
No, unfortunately, I don't.
Toronto?
Toronto? No.
Is it Montreal or Quebec? One of those.
Alberta?
No idea.
Quebec is the capital?
Is there a national capital?
Toronto? No.
It is Ottawa, by the way, where Canada's conservative government is now spending millions of loonies to do their own rebranding. Thank you very much. Canada's new image is of a strong nation of uncompromising fighters and an aggressive economy and a force on the world stage. Leon Nafok wrote about Canada's campaign to be a player for the Boston Globe, where he is staff writer for the Globe's ideas section. Leon, great to have you back with us.
Thank you for having me on.
It is such an easy target. All we know is Joni Mitchell, Tar Sands, Ryan Gosling, Shania Twain. Am I missing anything?
Well, I guess Celine Dion is the one that comes to mind.
Oh, my God.
Alanis Morissette, right?
How could I miss them?
Hockey.
We've heard plenty of jokes. Canada is America's hat. But how do the Canadians see themselves?
I think they see themselves as calm and reasonable people. In terms of their place, like on the world stage, I think they want to be seen as a sort of mediator, a helping hand, a sort of honest broker, or at least that's how it's traditionally been.
And now we have this campaign to rebrand Canada. Is it kind of a groundswell among Canadians, or is it coming from the top?
I think it's very much coming from the top. I mean, there are definitely like pockets of support for it from particularly like right-wing scholars and historians and political scientists, but mainly it's something that you're seeing come from the Stephen Harper government.
It's a conservative government.
Yes, very much so.
And so this is, I don't know, smacks of sort of nationalism?
You might even say like jingoism, you know, it's an attempt to kind of portray Canada as this strong and powerful, you know, militarily expansive and ambitious above all nation. That really matters on the world stage. It's not to be ignored.
I'm embarrassed to admit I don't know so much about the history of Canada, but can you give us a little, I don't know, a run through its military history?
Well, they were very much involved in like World War I, World War II. They had soldiers that lost their lives in those conflicts, and it's just always been sort of a fact of life that didn't contribute that much to like the national identity, I guess. The thing that I think Canadians felt much more connected to was the sort of peacekeeping tradition in Canada, where after World War II, you know, they even won a Nobel Peace Prize for a peacekeeping effort in the Suez Canal. It was something that, you know, it was understood that Canada was involved in wars, but they never led a war. They were never sort of seen as an aggressive country. When you asked about Canada's history, I mean, one of the things that I think has contributed to the way Canadians see themselves, or whether, you know, the extent to which they see themselves as a proud nation, is that they never really had like an emancipatory moment, sort of the way the United States did.
They didn't break free necessarily,
exactly,
as we did. Yeah.
But it kind of happened in fits and starts, and it took a while, and there was no like one moment you can point to and say, okay, that's when this great nation was born.
How much of this rebranding has to do with economics and being a player on the economic world stage?
Well, I think some of the folks I'd interviewed, you know, pointed to companies in Canada that are doing, you know, enormous business around the world. I think there is an idea that Canada can be, you know, a trading partner with more than just the U.S., that they could be selling their oil to, you know, more than just the U.S. There's also kind of looming over the whole story this prospect of a newly cleared Northwest Passage as the Arctic ice melts.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, when that happens, and by all accounts it seems to be happening, you know, it's kind of a free-for-all. There's a bunch of different countries who want access to it, who claim rights to it. You know, and then there's certainly like diplomatic process underway to figure out sort of who gets what and how it'll all work. But it can be an extremely lucrative trade route, and not to mention the enormous amounts of natural resources that are up there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that sort of looms over Canada as a potentially transformative development.
Interesting. One of the countries that actually stands to gain by global warming and
the melting
of Arctic ice. We're talking with Leon Nafalk. He's a writer for the Boston Globe Ideas section, and he wrote about Canada's recent efforts to rebrand itself in an article called Global Domination. Whoa, Canada! How do Canadian citizens feel about this state-sponsored rebranding?
I think just based on like some of the emails I received after the piece ran, it's something that they're aware of that the government is doing, and it's something that they're not comfortable with. It's like something that really cuts against how they see themselves and how they see their country.
It is, you know, interesting. You think of all this chest thumping as, well, kind of American, honestly.
Totally. Yeah, and I think like one thing I kept hearing over and over again when I was reporting the story was that if there's one thing you can say about like Canadians and their kind of national identity, and how they perceive their national identity, it's that they're not America. Mm. You know, America, especially under George W. Bush, you know, was seen as this hyper-aggressive, like, you know, arrogant nation that wanted to impose its will around the world. Whereas Canada, again, sort of had this, like, very distinct peacekeeping tradition where they were sort of, their job in the world was not to police the world, but to mediate conflicts and prevent others from tearing each other apart. So I think for them to see the Harper government kind of sounding these notes that really remind them quite a lot of, you know, American nationalism, it feels wrong. It feels like the opposite of how they've self-identified for as long as they've been around.
So what does it mean when the government starts a rebranding campaign? Are there commercials? Or is there new statues? I mean, how is this projected to Canada and the world at large?
Yeah, well, so, you know, one thing that people kept referring to was this elaborate ceremony that was staged following the fall of Muammar Gaddafi on basically the equivalent of Capitol Hill in Canada, which is called Parliament Hill. You know, it was extremely expensive. I think it was about $800,000 that cost. Like, some very large amount of money was spent on celebrating the country's military and its contribution to unseating Gaddafi. I think a lot of people looked at that and said, God, that's not really what we're about. You know, I guess we're proud of our military, but it's not the thing that we applaud in this way. This is a very American way to be. Another thing that people referred to a lot in conversation with me was just how Harper's government has spoken to like international bodies. There was a UN meeting in New York where Harper kind of just snubbed them, and he was in New York, but he didn't go. And he went instead to some award ceremony across town, and that was widely seen as a snub of the UN, which, you know, for decades was closely associated with Canada because Canada helped the UN so much with supplying peacekeeping forces. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, his foreign affairs officer gave a speech at the UN that was widely seen as very belligerent towards the UN, and I think he accused them of endless, fruitless, inward-looking exercises, you know, that really telegraphed to people back home that this is like a very different kind of Canada that these guys are imagining.
Oh, so pugnacious on the hockey rink and at the UN.
Yeah, well, it's funny. One of the guys I interviewed was like, hockey is the only thing in which our people come with a sense of superiority. You know, we come to the hockey rink against America, we know we're going to win. But we don't feel that way about anything else, about business, about politics, about anything. And we should. That's the difference, you know, between a country that has ambitions for itself and a country that is content to be a middle power.
A middle power. Boy, that's an epithet.
They were very proud of that name for a long time.
Really?
I think you would find that most Canadians are looking at this campaign and they're saying, I hope this does not work.
Well, Leon Neyfakh, I really want to thank you for telling us what it's all about.
You're waiting for that one, huh?
I just couldn't help myself.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Leon Neyfakh, the ideas reporter for the Boston Globe. He wrote about Canada's new rebranding efforts in an article called Global Domination. Whoa, Canada! You'll find links to more in the article, as well as other news related to the rebranding, including the Studio 360 campaign. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. You know you love me. Stay with us for Love and Robots. We'll have that story when word of mouth continues. What are you saying? Said there's another look right in my eyes. My first love broke my heart for the first time. And I was like, baby, baby, baby. Oh, like, baby, baby, baby. No, like, baby, baby, baby. Oh, thought you'd always be from New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2005, the International Center for Photography in New York City opened the Young America exhibit, largely featuring a collection of ghostly daguerreotypes, antique images made through the pioneering process that paved the way to modern photography. The show opened to enthusiastic reviews, but within weeks, many of the historic images began disappearing before the curator's very eyes, aging decades in a matter of days. It was one of the greatest museum mysteries to date and a nightmare for art conservationists. Daniel Grushkin is a freelance journalist, and his article, The Case of the Disappearing Daguerreotypes, follows an unlikely team of collaborators working to save the precious images for the December issue of the Scientific American. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
I'm curious, could you describe what a daguerreotype looks like for someone who's never seen one before?
So if you've seen a photo of a daguerreotype, it's not doing it justice. Daguerreotypes are absolutely stunning. Just imagine a flat rectangle of silver, and in it is the image of the subject, and it sort of hovers right behind the surface of the daguerreotype. It has this sort of ghostly luminescence. The New York Times called it, or when they wrote the review of the exhibit, they said they glowed like stones in the mood ring.
And you actually, on the Scientific American website, there is a slideshow that listeners can link to from our website. But tell us how they were made exactly. What gave them that sort of image of slightly hovering remove?
Louis Daguerre basically took 10 years to figure out how to make them. But when he did, it was a three-part process. Essentially, he would expose the daguerreotype to something called a halogen, which is a type of element on the periodic table, which would sort of cause the silver to create a single amalgam with that halogen. Then he'd expose them to light, which would actually imprint the image on them. The photons would kick off that halide. And then the final process would be to expose it to mercury. And the mercury would basically create crystals on the surface of the silver that became the image.
Now, in your article, you write about what went wrong, or actually that something went horribly wrong at this Young America exhibition. What was happening to the images, these daguerreotype images, some of them more than 150 years old?
So basically, there were 25 of them showed damage and 5 of them critically. Essentially, what happened was some of the images, literally before people's eyes, started to cloud over. Other ones blistered. And what they suspect was happening, and this is now after years of research, after the actual museum showing, was that these daguerreotypes were made by Southworth and Hawes, who had a Boston studio. They were working in the salty air of Boston, and so chlorine, which also happened to be a halogen, was on the surface of those plates. And so when exposed to light, you know, the beam of light in an exhibit started to actually reprocess or re-expose on the surface of those silver plates.
So a group of conservators worked with, what, physicists trying to
figure out how to stop this damage from happening. How did this team get together and what did they do?
You have to understand that a daguerreotype, even though, you know, you think of photography as an ancient process, what they were actually doing was nanotechnology at its first iteration. And so to figure out actually what was happening on that surface, on a molecular level, they needed to team up with physicists. So Ralph Wiegand, the conservator who put together the exhibition, teamed up with a team at University of Rochester, Nicholas Bigelow, who actually studies clouds of atoms at near zero temperatures, and they started to do the research together. The interesting thing that they found was that not only on the surface was the daguerreotype sort of degrading, but beneath the surface as well. And there was they discovered a series of tunnels beneath the daguerreotype surface, obviously on the nano level, that also caused that degradation.
So in order to restore them, they're basically tucking these away, right? Would they ever be fully restored?
Well, you have to think about it. You know, if you were a collector or owner of one of these things, you would hate to see them destroyed because you can't replace them. It's not like there's a negative. So out of fear, a lot of people have been tucking them away. The only thing that it seems like they can do at this point is put them in an environment where those reactions can't happen, where the chlorine can't form new crystals and mar the image.
Well, you were one of the last people to look at them in person before they were put away. What was that like?
You know, there are times where it feels, you know, I feel very lucky to have my job, and that was certainly one of them. I got a private viewing of these pieces outside of their frames, and they were just absolutely stunning. I mean, you just look at this image, and it's almost like you know the person. You know, you can almost reach through that mirror-like surface and touch them. Stunning. They're really just masterworks of photographic art.
Daniel Grushkin is a freelance science journalist whose work has appeared in Slate, Business Week, and other publications. We found his recent article, The Case of the Disappearing Daguerreotype, in the December issue of Scientific American, where you'll also find a slideshow of some of these startling yet threatened images that we spoke of today. And now, capturing human likeness on a whole other level.
Ooh, nice with your familiar face.
It should be.
How rude.
I believe the quantum fissure we discovered is a fixed point across the space-time continuum.
Wally.
From C-3PO to Wall-E, lovable robots have squeaked their way into the hearts and minds of audiences and readers. Over the past few years, thousands of varieties of real-life robots have jumped from the screen into homes, hospitals, and fields of combat. As the presence of these socially responsive robots grows, so does the human tendency to anthropomorphize their mechanical companions. Joining us to discuss the growing phenomenon of robot-human bonding is Robert Ito. He wrote about the topic for Pacific Standard magazine. Robert, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you.
You recently had your own experience of bonding with a robot. Will you tell us a little bit about Bandit?
Bandit is a robot that was developed at USC, and it's used in sort of a variety of different therapeutic ways, and one of them is working with stroke victims. So I went in there and basically just tried to do some of the exercises with him. It was interesting because it was sort of a stripped-down brand of him. He didn't really communicate that much. But just having him in the room, you certainly felt this presence, and that's sort of what got me, I think, interested in this topic.
What does Bandit look like?
In terms of socially assistive robots, he actually does look somewhat human. He has a round face. He's got very anime-looking, the big round eyes. He's got a nice smile. He's sort of what you would imagine a robot would look like watching it on, you know, sci-fi films.
Well, there are so many robots that are assisting now with, as you said, therapeutic reasons for stroke, patients with Alzheimer's, PTSD. And you write about the surprising level of affection that people bestow upon these even simplistic robots. How do people think of them?
I mean, that's a really interesting question, because one of the reasons that these engineers and robot designers are sometimes surprised at how people react to them is that they're not really designing them to be likable or lovable. Their primary goal is to create a robot that does what they want it to do. You want it to speak. You want it to raise its arm. You want it to react to certain cues. And the main goal isn't necessarily to create something that a human is going to like. I think there are certain things that, you know, people react to. They react to, just as I did, the big eyes, the round face, the sort of simple features.
So these human-like and animal-like characteristics, I guess, play into the attraction. But you spoke with a number of people who are actually studying this bond. Now, is there any real problem with having a patient or a soldier or people in general, I guess, having feelings for their robots?
Well, I think, you know, there are these sort of ethical concerns because they're falling for these robots that really can't return any of their feelings. And I think there's a certain contingent in the field that considers that creating these robots is inherently unethical because you're sort of tricking people into believing that these things have emotions. But on the most basic level, you have machines who are sort of batting their eyes at you, saying they love you, helping you. I mean, who wouldn't fall for someone, you know, or something like that? One possible fix, of course, is that you make them less human.
But Robert, you spoke to people who, you know, feel this way about their Roombas. You know, they're just as, you know what I mean? It's not that selective.
Right. Oh, yeah. And that's absolutely true. And in terms of the Roombas, so many of them, they have no idea why they fall for these things. I mean, that was, I think, one of the things that I got the most from them was, I don't know why I'm naming him. I don't know why I bought these clothes for him.
Well, it just strikes me as, you know, we're projecting something. I guess there's a sort of need for companionship if, you know, something that doesn't even look human or open its eyes. I mean, there's a photograph in the article, the Lovebot, of this Japanese seal Pero. It looks like a plush toy. I mean, that looks adorable and cute, but I can't imagine embracing. And you talk about people embracing, wanting to hug their robots.
Right. Well, I think part of that, too, is just simple gratitude. I mean, in terms of the Roombas, you know, you talk to them, they're just happy that somebody's helping with a house clean. In terms of, you know, these sort of bomb-diffusing robots, you know, in that case, it's certainly gratitude because these are saving people's lives. And so I think that also comes into the mix as well.
You mean you found soldiers that have affection for their bomb-diffusing robots?
Yes. I mean, and that had come out a while back where sometimes, of course, yeah, as you would imagine, the bomb-diffusing robots get blown up. And these Marines became very attached to them and saw them, you know, certainly as, I think, fellow warriors. And, you know, I think they went through a certain mourning period because here are these robots that had served alongside of them, and they had, you know, effectively died.
Well, when you spent time with Bandit, did you worry about getting carried away?
No, not really, just because I knew it was going to be sort of a limited experience, but I think it's one of the things that was sort of interesting to me was that it's not just the patients that sort of form these bonds. As one might sort of expect, some of the creators and engineers of these robots also start feeling, feelings of affection for them. And part of that is because, you know, they do spend so much more time than I would ever spend with these robots. But then also they were their creators. And so in terms of seeing them, they might, you know, perhaps see them as their own children.
Mm. Robert Ito, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Robert Ito is a writer for Pacific Standard Magazine, where we found his article, The Love Bot. There's a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. With that, the magic spell is cast and draws to a close for another week of Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for joining us and for just an hour putting on a pair of rose-colored glasses. Please join us again for more Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie,
with web support from Sarah Plort.
Andrew Perella, that's me.
provides technical support.
And Dan Kogan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR.
Its board of trustees or its underwriters.
That's right, right.
For information about the show, to subscribe to our podcast, post a comment, or to read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Cool.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
Hold me close and hold me fast. The magic spell you cast. This is love beyond rose. When you kiss me, heaven sighs. And though I close my eyes, I see love and rose. When you press me to your heart, and in a world apart, a world.